This is a reading of Rudolf Steiner's lecture cycle called According to Luke, the Gospel of Luke, lecture cycle, 10 lectures, also called the Gospel of Compassion and Love Revealed. And it was given in 1909, I believe. I don't have the dates right offhand here, so I'll get those to you later. Lecture 1 is called The Four Gospels in the Light of Anthroposophy. The last time we were together here, we discussed Christian esoteric currents from the perspective of the Gospel according to John. We opened our spiritual eyes to mighty images and ideas by immersing ourselves in that document. On that occasion, I stressed several times that studying the John Gospel, which is unique in the religious history of humankind, reveals Christianity's greatest depths, and I told you that the perspectives acquired through a study of that gospel are in some respects the most profound possible perspectives. Consequently, many of you who attended either that lecture series or another cycle on the John Gospel may wonder today whether we can augment or deepen those perspectives in any way by considering other Christian documents, such as the Gospels according to Luke, Matthew, and Mark. Knowing that we encounter the most profound Christian truths in the John Gospel, those who prefer not to overexert themselves in theoretical matters may question the necessity of further study of the essential nature of Christianity from other perspectives, specifically the perspective of the Luke Gospel, which we may easily believe to be less profound. However, anyone who thinks they are making a significant statement by expressing such doubt is severely mistaken, not only because the essence of Christianity is infinitely great and can be illuminated from any number of different perspectives, but also because we can learn a great deal from the Luke Gospel that we cannot learn from the John Gospel, in spite of the infinite depths of the latter document. The profound Christian ideas we encountered in the cycle on the John Gospel do not represent the full depths of Christianity, which can indeed be approached from a different standpoint, as we will do in this lecture series, by focusing on the Luke Gospel from the perspective of anthroposophical spiritual science. We will first consider a few preliminary points that will help us understand what we can gain from studying the Luke Gospel, even after plumbing the depths of the John Gospel. Our point of departure will be a fact that becomes apparent when we apply anthroposophical perspectives to even a single line of the John Gospel, namely that the Gospels were written by individuals with an especially penetrating view of the nature of life and existence. Such people who are able to see into the depths of the cosmos are called initiates and clairvoyants. In casual conversation, we use these terms more or less interchangeably, but when we approach deeper layers of spiritual life in our anthroposophical studies, we must distinguish between these two categories of individuals who find their way into supra-sensible realms. There is indeed a difference between an initiate and a clairvoyant, although nothing prevents an initiate from also being a clairvoyant, and the reverse is also true, at least to a certain extent. To distinguish precisely between these two types of supra-sensible experience, we must recall the three levels of perception that transcend our ordinary perception of the world. These levels are explained in my book, How to Know Higher Worlds. The type of cognition that is immediately accessible to us can be described by saying that we perceive the world through our senses and apply our reason and our other soul powers to these perceptions to make them our own. In addition, however, the world can be understood on three other levels. The first is the level of so-called imaginative cognition, the second is inspired cognition, and the third can be called intuitive cognition, if we use the word intuitive in its true spiritual scientific sense. Who possesses imaginative cognition? Individuals whose spiritual eyes perceive a mighty cosmic tableau of images spread out behind the sense-perceptible world. These images are very different from what we call images in ordinary life. The laws of three-dimensional space do not apply to the images of imaginative cognition, which also have other unique qualities that prevent them from being easily compared to anything in the ordinary sense-perceptible world. To gain a conception of the imaginative world, consider a plant and imagine extracting its visible element from its solid form, so that the plant's colors then float freely in the air. If we simply extricate color from a plant and allow it to float freely, the result is a dead figure that consists of color. The preparatory exercises clairvoyance practice, however, ensure that such a form does not remain dead to them. Instead, it is enlivened by the plant's spiritual aspect, just as the plant's material aspect enlivens it in the sense-perceptible world. The resulting free-floating form is not dead, but consists of colored light that is inwardly enlivened, glimmering and sparkling in a great variety of ways. Each color then expresses one attribute of a soul spiritual being that is imperceptible to the sensory world. In other words, to clairvoyance, the colors in a sense-perceptible plant express soul spiritual beings. Now imagine a world filled with a myriad of gleaming, constantly changing colored figures. Instead of simply seeing colors, however, as you would if these flickering color reflexes were captured in a painting, you must imagine that they all express soul spiritual beings. For example, the sudden appearance of a green image indicates the presence of a rational being, while a bright red image expresses a passionate nature. I could just as easily choose a different example and ask you to imagine a sea of interpenetrating sounds, smells, or tastes, which also express the soul spiritual beings standing behind them. But for the moment, please simply think of the imaginative world as a sea of interpenetrating colors. This world is real and has nothing to do with quote-unquote imagination in the ordinary sense of the word. There is nothing illusory about it. It is simply revealed to us through a different mode of perception than the sense-perceptible world. Within this imaginative world, we encounter everything that underlies the sense-perceptible world and cannot be perceived with our physical senses. Entities such as human ether and astral bodies, for example. Imaginative cognition teaches clairvoyance about higher beings from an external perspective, just as you learn about other people from the outside when you pass them on the street. You get to know these people better if you have the opportunity to talk with them. Through their words, they express aspects of themselves that are different from what you see when you simply watch them passing by on the street. For example, you cannot tell whether some of these passers-by are filled with pain or pleasure, grief or delight. Their emotional state becomes evident, however, when you speak with them. In the former instance, you experience people from the outside and learn about them without their active participation, while in the latter instance, they express themselves to you. The same is true of beings in the supersensible world. Clairvoyants, who learn about such beings through imaginative cognition, recognize soul-spiritual externalities, as it were. Those who ascend from imaginative cognition to the level of inspired cognition, however, truly interact with these same beings and hear them express themselves. From within themselves, these beings communicate who and what they are. Thus, inspiration is a higher cognitive level than mere imagination, and teaches us more about the beings of the soul's spiritual world. The word intuition, if used in its true spiritual scientific meaning, rather than in the ordinary sense of any unclear thought that occurs to us, signifies a still higher cognitive level. At this level, we do not simply listen in spirit to what beings tell us from within themselves. Instead, we become one with other beings by submerging ourselves in them. This higher level of spiritual cognition requires us to develop such love for all beings that we no longer distinguish between ourselves and the other beings in our spiritual surroundings. Our own essence pours into the spirit that surrounds us and exists inside rather than outside the other beings with whom we interact. Because this can happen only in the divine spiritual world, the term intuition, which means standing in God, is fully justified. Thus, imagination, inspiration, and intuition are the three levels of perceiving the supersensible world. Of course, it is possible to acquire all three levels, but an individual may achieve only the level of imagination in one particular incarnation. We call such people clairvoyants. Although the spiritual domains that can be reached only through inspiration and intuition remain hidden to them. Nowadays, aspiring esotericists are generally not permitted to ascend to the higher levels of suprasensible cognition without first passing through the stage of imagination. Under modern circumstances, it is therefore almost impossible for anyone to omit this stage and proceed directly to the level of inspiration or intuition. This would not be the right way to proceed today, but it could and did occur at certain other times in humankind's evolution. At certain times in human history, the different levels of suprasensible cognition were distributed among different individuals who possessed either imagination or inspiration and intuition. In certain mystery centers, people learned to open their spiritual eyes and clairvoyantly perceived the realm of imagination, the world of symbolic images. Having become clairvoyant to this extent, these people renounced any further aspiration to inspiration and intuition. As a result, they learned to perceive clearly and precisely in the imaginative world through more intensive training. They became specialists in imaginative perception, so to speak. This specialization, however, resulted in a specific need. Anyone who wants to behold the imaginative world while renouncing the possibility of ascending to the worlds of inspiration and intuition lives in a world of uncertainty. If left to its own devices in the boundless, fluid world of imagination, the human soul drifts hither and thither without any specific goal or direction. Inspiration and intuition supply certainty in the spiritual world. They show us where the path leads and where the goal is. Thus, cultures and times in which imaginatively clairvoyant individuals forswore higher levels of cognition always required such individuals to be devotedly attached to a guide who possessed the spiritual perceptive powers of inspiration and intuition. Without inspired cognition, we cannot know where a path leads or how to reach a goal. Those who cannot acquire such knowledge for themselves must trust in the expert guidance of those who can. That is why so many spiritual paths quite rightly insist that students who have only recently achieved imaginative cognition need an intimate connection to a guru or guide who can supply directions and goals that they cannot provide for themselves. Conversely, at certain times, it proved useful to allow certain other people to omit the stage of imaginative cognition and proceed directly to inspired or even intuitive cognition. Such people renounced the ability to perceive imaginative images of the spiritual world around them, and devoted themselves exclusively to impressions of the spiritual world that flow from within spiritual beings. With ears of spirit, they listened as the beings of the spiritual world spoke. This situation can be compared to being unable to see a person you hear speaking from behind a wall. Individuals can indeed renounce spiritual vision in order to proceed more quickly to spiritual hearing, which permits them to know what other spiritual beings express. Regardless of a person's ability or inability to see the imaginative world, if that person's spirit ear hears what beings in the suprasensible world have to say about themselves, we say that such a person is gifted with the quote-unquote inner word, in contrast to the outer word exchanged by human beings in the physical world. It is quite possible for some people who cannot see the imaginative world to possess the inner word, to hear and convey what spiritual beings express. At certain times in human evolution, these two types of suprasensible experience worked together in the mysteries. By renouncing one type of perception, seers of both sorts were able to enhance both the clarity and precision of their own abilities and the quality of their interaction in the mysteries. Imaginative clairvoyants were specially trained in seeing the world of images, while others bypassed the world of imagination and underwent intensive training in perceiving the inner word through inspiration. The experiences that resulted from specialized training could then be conveyed by seers of one type to the others. This was possible in times when interpersonal trust was cultivated to a degree that our modern evolution prohibits. Today's human beings do not trust each other enough to be satisfied with hearing others describe images of the imaginative world and subsequently adding what they themselves have learned from inspiration. Our faith in the accuracy of other people's depictions is not strong enough. Although the practice was quite common at certain times in the past, very few modern individuals would be content with developing imagination one-sidedly. At our present stage of development, individuals must be led gradually through all three stages of higher cognition without omitting any of them. At all levels of supersensible cognition, we encounter great mysteries related to the so-called Christ event. Imaginative cognition, inspired cognition, and intuitive cognition each have much to say about this central event. Bearing this in mind as we consider the four Gospels, we can conclude that the John Gospel was written from the standpoint of an initiate who perceived the supersensible world on all levels of cognition, including intuition. If we look closely at the unique features of the John Gospel, however, we see, as we shall also see in this lecture cycle, that it describes events especially clearly from the perspectives of inspiration and intuition, while its imaginative images are pale and unclear. Leaving aside the lesser imaginative content of this gospel, we can say that its author conveyed all aspects of the Christ that are revealed to those who possess the inner word and intuition. Because the John Gospel is based on inspired and intuitive cognition, its author essentially describes the mysteries of Christ's kingdom as imbued with the inner word, or logos. The other three Gospels are different. Of these three authors, Luke expresses himself most clearly. The Luke Gospel begins with a strange little preface, saying in effect that after many attempts by earlier writers to compile and recount all the stories circulating about events in Palestine, the Gospel writer, in his turn, has decided to attempt to recount, and these are significant words, the knowledge of those who from the very beginning have been the, quote, eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, unquote, to quote the usual translation of Luke 1:1-2. That is, the author of the Luke Gospel intends to convey the statements of eyewitnesses, the term would be better translated as independent seers, and ministers or servants of the word. In the Luke Gospel, the term independent seers means people who possess imaginative cognition, and therefore have access to the world of images where they perceive a Christ event. Thus the Luke Gospel is based on the accounts of individuals who were not only specially trained in imagination and able to perceive clearly and exactly, but who were also servants of the word. This term is significant. Rather than saying possessors of the word, that is, of inspired cognition, Luke says servants of the word, servants of those with access to the pronouncements of the inspired world, but no direct personal access to imaginations. Inspired teachers convey their perception to the servants, who are then able to proclaim it. The servants themselves, however, do not possess the word. Thus the Luke Gospel is based on the accounts of independent seers, of individuals capable of direct personal experience in the imaginative worlds, who have also become, quote-unquote, servants of the word, by applying the resources of their inspired teachers to expressing their own visions. Here again we have an example of how carefully the Gospels are worded, and how literally we must understand each word. In documents based on spiritual science, everything is very precise and exact. Modern human beings are often totally unaware of how carefully the words in such documents were chosen. When we begin the study of any subject from the spiritual scientific perspective, we must remind ourselves that physical documents, in this case the Gospels, are not the source of anthroposophical knowledge. The fact that an event is described in the Gospels does not necessarily make it true for those who base themselves exclusively on spiritual science. Spiritual scientists gather knowledge not from written documents, but from the findings of contemporary spiritual scientific research. As such, spiritual scientific sources consist of what the beings of the spiritual world disclose to contemporary initiates and clairvoyants. In certain respects, modern sources are the same as the sources of earlier historical periods. Thus today, as in the past, people with insight into the imaginative world can be called clairvoyants, while the term initiates can be used to describe only those who achieve inspiration and intuition. The terms clairvoyant and initiate need not coincide. The content of the John Gospel must be based on the research of an initiate who achieved inspired and intuitive cognition. In contrast, the content of the other Gospels is based on accounts by imaginatively clairvoyant individuals who are not yet able to ascend to the inspired and intuitive worlds. Having made this distinction, we can say that the John Gospel is based on initiation, while the other three Gospels, especially the Luke Gospel, as its author himself states, are based on clairvoyance. But because it enlists the perceptions of the most highly trained clairvoyants, the Luke Gospel presents exact images, where the John Gospel provides only faded pictures. Let me describe this difference still more precisely. Although it is almost never the case today, it is possible for an individual to be initiated into the worlds of inspiration and intuition, while clairvoyance, that is, the understanding of the imaginative world, is withheld. Suppose that such a person then encounters a non-initiated clairvoyant who has access to the imaginative world and can see the entire spectrum of imaginations. A person of the latter type would be able to convey a great deal of information to the non-clairvoyant initiate. The latter, although unable to perceive the imaginative world directly, might in turn be able to explain imaginative visions on the basis of inspiration. Today many people are clairvoyant without being initiates, but the reverse is almost never the case. Nonetheless, it is conceivable that potentially clairvoyant initiates might remain unable to perceive imaginations for reasons specific to their individual cases. Clairvoyants would be able to tell such people much that they did not know before. We must always stress that anthroposophical spiritual scientific knowledge is derived directly from the sources of initiates rather than from documents like the John Gospel or the other Gospels. Spiritual researchers have access to their source at all times and need not resort to historical documents. When their research is complete, however, we can turn to the documents and compare them to spiritual scientific findings. Modern findings on the Christ event are wonderfully reflected in the John Gospel. The value of this document lies in the fact that its author wrote just like a modern initiate. The voice that resounds across the centuries is the same as the voice that we can hear today. Something similar is true of the other Gospels, including the Luke Gospel. The images its author presents are not the source of our knowledge of the higher world. We discover this source independently through our own ascent into that world. When we speak of the Christ event, the source of our insight is the great tableau of images and imaginations that we perceive when we focus our inner vision on what happened at the beginning of the Christian era. We then compare these images and imaginations to those depicted in the Luke Gospel. This lecture cycle is intended to show how imaginations achieved by modern individuals compare to the descriptions we encounter in the Luke Gospel. For spiritual research into events of the past, there is only one source, and it does not consist of material records. Stones dug out of the earth, documents preserved in archives, and historical writings, whether inspired or not, are not the source of spiritual science. For spiritual science, the only true source is the everlasting Akashic record, which allows us to understand past events without recourse to physical documents. Today, we can choose between two means of acquiring information about the past. We can look at physical records, historical documents if we want to learn about outer events, or religious documents if we want to learn about spiritual circumstances. Or we can ask what seers behold when the eyes of the spirit are opened to the everlasting chronicle we call the Akashic Record, the mighty tableau where everything that ever happened in the evolution of the cosmos, the earth, and humankind is written in an unchanging script. Aspiring esotericists gradually learn to read this chronicle. Its script is no ordinary script. Imagine past events appearing before your spirit eye. Foggy images of Caesar Augustus and all his actions, for example. Everything that ever happened is revealed to spirit vision, and this panorama is accessible to spiritual researchers at any time. They need no material proofs. When they turn their attention to a specific point in the evolution of the cosmos or of humankind, a spiritual image of events of that time presents itself to view. In this way, spiritual vision can roam through ages past. Its discoveries comprise the findings of spiritual research. What happened in the earliest days of the Christian era? These events can be seen with the spirit eye, and then compared to accounts such as those in the Luke Gospel. Having made this comparison, spiritual researchers know that their vision is shared by seers who lived at that time and saw the past in the same way. We can compare what these seers described as their present to what we discover in the Akashic record of their time. We must always keep in mind that our information comes from spiritual research, not from documents. Discovering the same information in historical documents simply enhances the value of the documents. We judge their truth on the basis of our own research. Documents increase in value as statements of the truth when we recognize the truth from other sources. It would be misleading to describe the situation, however, without pointing out that reading the Akashic record is not as easy as perceiving events in the physical world. Let me use perceiving a specific human being as an example of where the difficulties lie. From elementary anthroposophy, we know that the human being consists of the physical body, the etheric body, the astral body, and the eye. As soon as we enter the spiritual world, instead of observing the human being exclusively on the physical plane, we encounter certain difficulties. When you see a human being in the physical world, you confront that person's physical, etheric, and astral bodies and eye as a unity. Any human being we observe during the waking state unites all these members in a single entity. To observe the entirety of a human being who is not awake, however, we must ascend to higher worlds. We must enter the world of imaginations if we want to see the astral body, which separates from the physical body during sleep. The being we attempt to observe is split into two parts. This is where the difficulties begin. What I will describe next seldom actually happens, because observing the human being is relatively easy, but at least this example will help you understand the potential difficulties. Imagine entering a room where a number of people are sleeping. You see their physical bodies lying in bed, and, if you are clairvoyant, their ether bodies. Rising up a level, you perceive their astral bodies clairvoyantly. In the astral world, however, the principle of interpenetrability applies. That is, astral bodies pass through each other. It is possible to confuse which astral body belongs to which physical body. Trained clairvoyants are not easily confused in such instances, because this type of perception belongs to one of the lowest levels, and people who reach this level are well prepared to distinguish between astral bodies. The difficulties become significant, however, when we observe beings other than human beings in the higher world, or when we attempt to track a human being through multiple incarnations, rather than only in the present. To research where the eye of a certain living person was in a previous incarnation, you must pass through the world of the Devakan to that person's previous incarnation. You must be able to ascertain which eye belongs to the individual in question in each of the preceding incarnations. Relating the continuity of the eye to the different levels down here on earth becomes complicated. It is very easy to make a mistake when you look for a particular eye in earlier bodies. As a general rule, when we enter higher worlds, it is not easy to relate all the aspects of a personality to the Akashic record of an individual's earlier incarnations. Imagine that as clairvoyants or initiates, we assign ourselves the task of determining the physical ancestors of one John Miller, whom we know in the physical world. Let's assume that we must rely on the Akashic record, because all physical documents have been lost. We would have to ascertain all of John's physical ancestors, father, mother, grandfather, and so on the basis of the Akashic record, in order to see how his physical body evolved through heredity. But if we want to investigate John Miller's earlier incarnations, the path we must follow is completely different from the one leading to his physical ancestors. To trace the earliest incarnations of his eye, we may need to go back in time through many eras. We encounter two different currents here. The physical body is not a totally new creation, because it is descended from its ancestors through the physical line of heredity. The I, too, is not a new entity, because it is linked to earlier incarnations. The same is also true, however, of the intermediary members, the ether body and the astral body. Most of you already know that the ether body is not a totally new entity, and that it may have passed through a variety of manifestations. In a previous lecture, for example, I told you that Zarathustra's ether body reappeared as the ether body of Moses. These historical figures had the same ether body. Tracing Moses's physical ancestors would result in one line of descent, but tracing the ancestors of his ether body would result in another line, leading back to Zarathustra and other ether bodies. When we trace the descent of a physical body, an ether body, or an astral body, we must follow a totally different current in each instance. Each member of the human constitution points in a completely different direction. It is true that the present ether body is the reincarnation of an ether body that was formerly incarnated in a different individuality, that is, not the individuality in which the I was previously incarnated. The same is true of the astral body. When we arrive in higher worlds in search of an individual's previous members, these currents separate. Each one carries us in a different direction, and we discover very complicated processes in the spiritual world. To gain a complete understanding of an individual from the perspective of spiritual research, we cannot simply describe him or her as the descendant of physical ancestors, nor can we simply state from which being the present ether body or astral body is derived. We must describe the paths followed by each member until all four converge in the present being, and we cannot trace all these paths at once. One investigator may discover important information by tracing the path of the ether body, while another traces the path of the astral body. Different investigators may place more emphasis on different members and formulate their descriptions accordingly. To those who cannot perceive what a clairvoyant learns about an individual, it makes no difference what they hear, because all the aspects they are told about will seem to describe the same phenomenon. To them, an investigator who simply describes the physical personality is saying the same thing as when it describes the ether body, and they will believe that both are describing the being of John Miller. I hope this illustrates the complexity of the circumstances we encounter when we attempt to describe the being behind any phenomenon in the cosmos, whether a human being or a non-human being, from the perspective of the research conducted by clairvoyants and initiates. I needed to demonstrate that only very comprehensive, multi-directional research in the Akashic Record yields a clear spiritual view of a specific being. When we consider the being described by the John Gospel, whether we call him Jesus of Nazareth before the baptism in the Jordan or the Christ afterward, we see an I, an astral body, an etheric body, and a physical body. To describe this being completely, and from the perspective of the Akashic Record, we must trace the paths these four members of the Christ Jesus being followed through human history. Only then will we fully understand this being. A complete and modern spiritual scientific understanding of accounts of the Christ event illuminates the seemingly contradictory accounts in the four Gospels. I have often said that purely materialistic modern scholarship, which cannot understand that a higher initiate has more profound and penetrating perceptions than others, fails to recognize the great truth and value of the John Gospel. Scholars who are uncomfortable with the John Gospel attempt to impose some sort of harmony on the other three Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels. This harmony is difficult to achieve, however, as long as we base it on material events. For example, the life of Jesus of Nazareth before the baptism in the Jordan, which will be the subject of subsequent lectures, is described so differently by two evangelists, the authors of the Matthew and Luke Gospels, that, to a materialistic way of thinking, the differences between their accounts are no less significant than the differences between the John Gospel and the other three Gospels. Consider the facts. The Matthew Gospel describes how the birth of the founder of Christianity is predicted and comes to pass, and how wise men from the east follow the star that leads them to his birthplace. Herod's attention is attracted by these events, and the Redeemer's parents flee with the child to Egypt to escape Herod's preemptive measure, the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem. After Herod's death, Jesus' father Joseph is told that he can return home, but out of fear of Herod's successor, he settles in Nazareth instead of returning to Bethlehem. If we compare the accounts of the Annunciation of the birth of Jesus of Nazareth in the Luke and Matthew Gospels, we find them very different. In one account, the birth is announced to Joseph, and in the other, to Mary. We will disregard for today the Annunciation of the birth of John the Baptist. From the Luke Gospel, we learn that the parents of Jesus of Nazareth were originally from Nazareth, but were in Bethlehem for the census when Jesus was born. There is no mention of a flight to Egypt. The infant was circumcised 8 days after birth and presented in the temple a short time later when the customary sacrificial offering was made. The parents then returned with the child to Nazareth to live. Then we are told of a strange turn of events. When visiting Jerusalem with his parents, the 12-year-old Jesus remained behind in the temple, and when they looked for him, they found him surrounded by scholars interpreting the scriptures. He seemed expert in scriptural interpretation and amazed them with his wisdom and understanding. Then we are told that his parents took the boy home with them to Nazareth, where he grew up, and little more is said about him until the baptism in the Jordan. Thus we are confronted with two different accounts of the life of Jesus of Nazareth before he received the Christ being. The chief obstacle to uniting these accounts is how to reconcile the story of the family's flight to Egypt and subsequent return with an ordinary materialistic interpretation of the presentation in the temple according to Luke. On the physical level, these accounts appear completely contradictory, but we shall see that spiritual research sheds light on their truth. The three synoptic Gospels, the Gospels according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are intended to force us to accept a spiritual interpretation of historical events. We must realize that nothing is accomplished by refusing to think about the apparent contradictions in these documents or by calling them fictitious when reality proves impenetrable. The Luke Gospel provides an opportunity to talk about issues not raised by the John Gospel, specifically about events leading up to the Christ being's entry into the three bodies of Jesus of Nazareth during his baptism in the Jordan. Many significant riddles about the nature of Christianity will be solved when we hear what the Akashic Record says about the being of Jesus of Nazareth before this event. Tomorrow we will begin to examine the being and life of Jesus of Nazareth on the basis of the Akashic Record. We will then be able to ask how what it tells us about the true being of Jesus of Nazareth relates to the account in the Luke Gospel, which is based on the insight of individuals who called themselves, quote, independent seers, unquote, and, quote, servants of the Word, quote, or Logos, given in Basel, September 15th, 1909, the end of Lecture 1.